This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
This is from the teachings of Master Bodhidharma, the outlines of practice. Many roads lead to the path, but basically there are two, principle and practice. To enter by principle means to realize that the essence through instruction, and to believe that all living things have one true nature, which isn't apparent because it's shrouded by sensation and delusion. Those who turn from delusion back to reality, who meditate on walls, the absence of self and other, the unity of mortal and sage, and who remain unmoved even by scriptures, are in complete and unspoken agreement with principle. Without moving, without effort, they enter, we say, by principle. So this week, we've been in Sesshin and doing what we call our Bodhidharma Sesshin, which means it's one Sesshin of the year when there are no talks given, which is normal that they are given, and no face-to-face teaching. And so it's really a Sesshin when the Sangha is just all sitting together during the week, practicing together, in a lot of silence. And the sessions began years ago when Dada Roshi would go to Zen Center of Los Angeles in February to stay with his teacher and leave us alone. there were no seniors yet, and so there was no one to give talks and certainly no one to give interviews. So they began at that time, and then we just continued. And then I think at a certain point we started just making them normal sessions. And then a few years back we went back to that, to not having talks and interview, which was nice. So I wanted to, in honor of Bodhidharma, to draw on this teaching, which is the one teaching that scholars generally agree was from the figure of Bodhidharma, who's considered the first ancestor of the Zen tradition in China, and yet there's much mystery and unknown around his life, which is not so important for us here. And so here he's talking about two paths into practice, one by principle and one by practice. And principle is to understand on a very deep level the teachings themselves so that a person simply manifests those teachings as they sit and meditate on walls. This is speaking of Bodhidharma as having sat in the cave on Shaolin Mountain for some years and come to realize that reality, based the beginning in faith through their own practice, but just by manifesting it directly. And then there is the path by practice, which he describes having four all-inclusive practices. And I'm not going to be able to do these justice today, but there are some things I wanted to speak about, and so I'll try and do the best I can. now, of course, Bodhidharma is credited with having sort of defined or characterized the Zen tradition as a special transmission outside of the scriptures with no reliance on words and letters, a direct pointing to the human mind and the realization of Buddhahood. And so Westerners can sort of take from that Zen turns its back on the scriptures and on words and phrases, which is clearly not true. Not ever has that been true. And yet, this teaching is actually very important. It's saying something very, very essential about the role of sutras and teachings and words and phrases. Musō Sasaki said that in talking about what is deluded thinking, he said a scholar can not believe in this special transmission outside the scriptures, and just put all of their faith in doctrine and in intellectual understanding. A Zen practitioner, and that's deluded thinking, a Zen practitioner can believe wholeheartedly in not relying on words and letters and believe that that is apart from the teachings and any kind of intellectual understanding. That is also deluded thinking. And so how do we study? This is going to be something we'll be taking up in this Ango, when we're working with Dogen's fascicle on the body and mind study of the way. So how do we study the teachings so that they fulfill their actual purpose? And their purpose is to bring us directly to what Bodhidharma speaks about here. Their purpose is not just to add to the body of Dharma teachings or to the body of religious teachings in the world. It's to directly bring the practitioner to the realization of Buddha mind and the awakening of compassion. You know, as in the early days, there was so little to read. Of course, there was no internet. And so practitioners, most people coming in to study Buddhism, knew very little about Buddhism. Now people come in oftentimes being very well-read and can speak in very eloquent ways about non-duality and absolute and relative and so on and so forth, which is fine. But what does that all mean? Right? What do those words mean? Is there anything beyond the meaning of those words? So in the teachings, there's a speaking about how to experience, how to study, how to hear the teachings, and how not to. And so there's the teaching of the three vessels, which make it difficult to receive the teaching. So one is that there's an upturned vessel. There's a cup, if you will, a bowl, but it's turned upside down. And so that can be because the mind is distracted, and so we're just not able to hear. It could also be because we're not open. Right? So the teachings are being offered, but we're not listening. We're not interested. We're not receptive. There's no faith. There's no seeking. The second is a stained vessel. So there's the vessel is there, but it's stained or poisoned. And so that can be because the motivation is very weak or dubious. It can be because we're just wanting to hear a teaching so we can say, oh, I've studied from this person and this person, or I know this much and I know that much. It can be an intellectual attachment. It can be a way of just benefiting our own practice. Right? So we go to a teaching just to sort of get what we want, get what we need, but there's little sense of it being about anybody else. And then there's the leaky vessel, in which the vessel receives the teachings, but it doesn't hold. Right, it leaks out. So we're listening, but then we don't reflect on it. We don't contemplate. It doesn't find its way into our sitting in terms of motivating us or guiding us. We don't retain it. And so they don't go very deep. They just sort of skim across the surface and then they pass us by. An old master quoted the Buddha, who is said to have taught that owing to your study, you can understand the Dharma. Owing to your study, you can cease from creating harm and instead practice good. Owing to your study, you can abandon what is not important. And owing to your study, you can ultimately realize nirvana. How is it in our encountering the teachings, when we encounter teachings that are difficult, right, which happens all the time? Every day, if we're studying. And sometimes they're difficult because the teachings themselves are liberated from the self, but we're not. And so we're hearing them from the perspective of self and other. We're hearing them from the perspective of things are permanent, right? I can find ultimate satisfaction outside of myself. Attachments are okay, and so on. And so the teachings are very difficult they're hard to hear. They don't make sense. They're hard to have faith in. Sometimes they're difficult because what they're grounded in and require faith in is a way of seeing the world that is not yet our experience. Right? They're speaking of a reality that is not yet real for us yet. It's not true for us yet. We don't know this. We may have faith in it, but it's not yet our living experience. They may also be difficult because sometimes they seem to be teaching something or asking us to do something that seems counter to our basic sense of what the way the world works and what we should be doing as practitioners, even as compassionate beings. And in every time and place where Buddhism has existed, that's been true. Beginning with the time of the Buddha, there were teachings that he gave that were difficult to understand at his time. Sometimes because the Dharma itself was difficult, sometimes because the culture in which they were being given made them difficult. And when Buddhism went on to China and other Asian countries and out to the West, that has continued to be true for every generation in its own ways, in different ways. And then there's the question of is sometimes the reason the teachings are difficult is because they're based in a cultural context, which is not our cultural context, right? And how important is that? How influential is that in that teaching itself? So this is where, these are things that, in a sense, scholarship can help to a certain degree, but in the end, we have to work these matters out ourselves. And so I wanted to look at Bodhidharma's outlines of practice as a way of seeing this. And it's tricky because, well, you'll see. It's tricky to speak about, in a way, because of the danger, if not certainty, that it will be misunderstood by some in some ways. And while that is basically true every time the Dharma is being offered, sometimes it's more precipitous than others. And so to enter by practice, Bodhidharma says, includes four all-encompassing practices. And the first is, in one translation, the suffering of injustice. When the practitioner of training of the Dharma experiences suffering, one should think to oneself, for innumerable eons I have wandered through various states of existence, forsaking the fundamental for the inessential, for the unimportant, and generating in myself a great deal of enmity and distaste, anger and hatred, and bringing an unlimited amount of injury and discord upon others. Although I have not committed any offense in this lifetime, my present suffering, the suffering that I am experiencing, constitutes the fruition of these past actions and bad karma, rather than anything that is being given to me by any heavenly or non-human being. In other words, it's not something that's being put upon me by God, for instance, or some other deity. I shall accept it patiently and contentedly, completely without enmity or complaint. The sutra says, don't be saddened by the experience of suffering. Why? Because your mind, your consciousness, penetrates the fundamental. When you react to events in this fashion, understanding this, then you will be in accord with this absolute principle as you progress upon the path through the experience of the results of your past enmity. This is called the practice of the retribution of enmity. So here Bodhidharma is saying that when we experience suffering that is inflicted upon us by others in this lifetime, that's because we have committed negative actions in our past lives that are bearing fruit in this moment in that encounter. That because of the ways in which we've, in another translation, turned away from the essential and turned towards the trivial, wandered through all manners of existence, often angry without cause and guilty of numberless transgressions. Now, though I'm doing nothing wrong, I'm trying to live a good life, this is happening to me. And what the teaching is saying is know that that is because of past actions in previous lives that is bearing fruit in this moment. And that's why those moments are considered so important, because they're the opportunities to exhaust or shift that karma. Right? And so he says, accept it with an open, accept it patiently and contentedly, completely without enmity or complaint. When you do it in this way, your mind is in accord with the nature of things, and then you will easily progress along the path. Now, the world is filled with hatred, people who have hatred in their hearts and anger. And inevitably, that is inflicted upon others. And those people that we're talking about include us, by the way. And so what Buddhism is saying is because of our past actions, past lives, that karma is bearing fruit. In the Buddha's own enlightenment experience, he said that he saw into all of his past lives. He also said that he saw into all of the various actions that he and people commit and their consequences, how those particular actions bear fruit or have consequence. In other words, when you act this way, what particular kind of consequence does that lead to? Now, how do we understand this? So you can see how essential the understanding of rebirth is to this, because within that, a Buddhist path is not just this life, it's lifetimes, in which lifetime after lifetime, we are trying to work this out and move ourselves further along the path by practicing, by encountering the Dharma, by following the precepts, living good lives, taking vows, encountering the world we live in. And when we encounter the suffering that is inflicted upon us and the adversity that we experience by not perpetuating more suffering, but by trying to actually turn ourselves, in a sense, in a very real sense, into accord rather than discord with the reality of things. And in that way, come to liberation. And so you can see how powerful this is as a way of explaining, helping to understand why is this happening, right? How many times have people said this in the history of humanity? Why is this happening to me? Right? And every religion has to have some way of responding to it, because in every generation people want to know. Right? Why is this happening to me? And there not being a reason isn't good enough, right? We want to know. We want to have some sense of purpose and meaning in our lives, that this isn't just random craziness and chaos. And ultimately, I think, so that we can actually do something good with it, turn it into something good and positive. So it's not just a hell realm, but it's something that actually is leading us along a path. So we can see how enormously powerful that is. But what if you don't believe in rebirth? Uh-oh. Now what? It's very interesting. And what I'm sharing is, you know, a lot of what I've, you know, studied and learned through my own experience, and some just my own thought processes on this. So karma is intention, the Buddha said. Karma, intention, resides within individuals, within people. Intention is something that arises out of a way of seeing oneself in the world, that gives rise to a desire that becomes expressed and then made manifest through what we think, say, and do. And that creates karma. We also, in our time, in the West, we speak of collective karma, right? Because it's just too hard not to do that. It's irresistible to speak of the karma of a family or a sangha or a group of people or an organization or a nation, right? To speak of our own national karma, right? The legacy of having taken our land from indigenous people, the legacy of having taken other people from their land and brought them here through violence and oppression. Right, and then institutionalizing that. All of these different strands of our karma. But where is the intention? So if we speak about collective karma, and I've done this, do this, but where is the intention within an organization, within a group of people, within a government? Right? Now, we can certainly say that individual intentions can find their way into policy, into documents, into laws, and so on. But those laws themselves are fulfilling people's intention, but the organization, the government, the body doesn't have an intention. And so can we really speak of karma in the way that it's understood in Buddhism in that way? Because ultimately what it's about is taking responsibility. So if we want a group of people or an organization or a sangha or a government to take responsibility, we don't go talk to the building, right? Or we don't talk to the document. We want to talk to a person. We want to talk to people. Because we realize we have to change people's minds. We have to change people's intentions. We have to influence the way other people see the world. And we have to be doing all of those things for ourselves. I was reading an article by Greg Snyder, who's a friend and a Dharma teacher, the teacher of the Brooklyn Zen Center. And he wrote an article in Lion's Roar that's good. I encourage you to read it. In the aftermath of the shooting, and this latest shooting in Florida. And he says, talks about gun violence as, and having come from his own life of where there he knew violence, both as a perpetrator of violence and recipient of it, that when a person goes out and commits violence, that if we trace it back through the anger, right? So the violence is, you know, there's anger and there's desire, but ultimately there's humiliation, there's shame. There's deeply felt, difficult emotions that are being felt. And so that in a sense, all of violence is, as he says, is being committed by people, often primarily men, who can't tolerate their own thoughts and their sensations, their experience within their body. That it's as terrible and as simple as that. Not being able to tolerate the thoughts in my mind, the sensations in my body, not being able to tolerate them, I inflict them. I try and let them out on somebody else. And so then it's no small thing when you consider that in terms of what happens in Dharma practice, right? You come in, you're given a seat, you sit down, you face the wall of your own mind, and your practice is to tolerate. To face what is difficult to face, to hold what you don't want to hold, to acknowledge what you'd rather deny. So if we don't believe in rebirth, and we're experiencing the anger, the hatred of a person, or a group, or a government, or an institution, a society, then it becomes something of this moment. There's history, right? But it's something in this moment. We can't look to past lives to explain this. So why is this person doing this to me? Why is this organization, this society, this government not valuing me as a human being? It's not due to a previous life, but to their greed, anger, and delusion that's present in this life, to the hatred that exists in their heart. It may be due to negative actions that I've created, for sure. In other words, that I'm experiencing may be, in part at least, if not largely, a result of things that I have done, and in a certain sense have brought this upon ourselves. But what makes this so difficult, this particular teaching, is when we look at it in a larger societal way. And so when the first practice is to suffer injustice, whoa. What does that mean? How do we suffer injustice? What is this saying? But either way, whether we believe in rebirth or not, and my encouragement is to study the teachings, understand what it really means, which we can't get into today, But study them so that at least you, as a Buddhist practitioner, you understand what those teachings are about rebirth. And just let that be part of your consciousness. You know, this is one of those things that is difficult for many, perhaps most Western practitioners, because it's just not part of our, you know, story. I was at a teaching of Kongtrul Rinpoche, a Tibetan Buddhist master, you know, with all of his students. I seemed to be one of the only sort of outliers, not part of the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. And so I figure, and he was talking about rebirth, I figure, okay, well, he's talking to, you know, everybody who's like, you know, they're all on board. And at one point he said, look, he said, I just encourage you to keep an open mind. Just allow for the possibility that it might be true. And I thought, oh, okay, so not everybody's necessarily in agreement. But whether we do believe in it or not, in that moment, when we are experiencing injustice, when you're experiencing the anger, the hatred of somebody else, and of course that can be on, you know, along a whole spectrum from very, you know, minor to very significant and hurtful or life-threatening, that either way, we're in that moment, we have to deal with that moment. And that what Buddhism is saying is that ultimately we need to deal with our mind. And by ultimately doesn't mean dualistically, and which means it's not that what's happening out here does not matter. It happens significantly, particularly if your life is in danger. But ultimately, in the sense of our ultimate journey, is to get to the ground of being and to use everything within our lives and everything within our sensory experience and beyond to do that. How do we meet this moment? How do we practice the Dharma in this moment? Because whatever I'm experiencing in that moment, it takes resonance within my consciousness. Now I am having thoughts that have been influenced by my experience of you or of a group or of an institution. I am having feelings in association with those thoughts. I am beginning to form a discriminatory consciousness. What does this mean? Why is this happening? Is this good or bad? How do I feel about this? And I'm developing strategies. What do I do next? How do I respond? In other words, I am creating karma. And that, given whatever the circumstance I am in, and whatever actual injustice I may be experiencing, that belongs to me, that karma. Right? It's not all mine in the sense of it's not only caused because of my own consciousness, but as it arises in my consciousness, it's my responsibility because now I am acting within it. In the second practice, Bodhidharma says, this is the practice of acceptance of circumstances. Sentient beings have no unchanging self and are entirely subject to the impact of their circumstances. And whether you experience suffering or pleasure, both are generated from your circumstances. If you experience fame and fortune or other forms of superior consequence, you should realize that this is the result of past actions. Right? It's a result of past karma, whether it's past lives or just in this life. And although you may experience such good fortune now, when those circumstances are exhausted, that good fortune will disappear. How then can you take joy in good fortune as any kind of ultimate pleasure? Since success and failure depend on circumstances, the mind should remain unchanged. It should be unmoved even by the winds of good fortune, and mysteriously in accordance with the path. This is called the practice of acceptance of circumstances. So here we can see how closely related this is to this first practice of suffering and injustice or suffering adversity and accepting it, right, without retaliation, in patience. The circumstances are the conditions within which we live. And nothing is permanent, nothing is fixed. So whether those circumstances are giving us a lot of good stuff, here he's focusing on that and saying, don't, you know, understand that that's good And it's going to change. And so don't establish your happiness in that, because it doesn't belong to you. But this makes it clear why we try and manage our conditions, right, our circumstances, to do exactly that, to give us as much of whatever version of fame and fortune we're looking for. And to give us as little pain and suffering as we can manage. And because the conditions are so impactful, they are. Isn't that exactly why we go to so much effort and thoughtfulness to create the best circumstances and conditions here possible? In other words, let them work for us. Let them help us. Right? That are conducive to cultivating and practicing patience and tolerance and stillness and quiet and engaging each other, working, practicing. This is why, looking at it in a larger level, looking at how we put this together, how we put our society together, is also critical, because those are the circumstances in which people are living every day. I remember years ago when there was a lot going on in the legislature about that was affecting the prisons in terms of sentencing laws and so on, that I would read about these various laws that were enacted, you know, that I imagine a lot of people may not have been aware of or didn't care that much for it, because it's very remote, very abstract. It's affecting people that, you know, we don't know, and they're in prison. But when I would go to the prison and sit with the groups, it was incredibly impactful, right, in terms of how those laws were affecting the lives of these men and women every day. And so that's why creating an enlightened society, or the beloved community, is so important. That's why the Buddha took time to talk to people in power during his lifetime about how to govern in a way that is based in justice. But whatever those circumstances are, they will end. Right? Nothing lasts forever. Everything changes, so periods of peace lead to conflict. Stability to disruption, balance to imbalance. So we can't rely on those conditions. Again, we can't establish our peace or our happiness based in that. Right? So it's like every time there's an election, some people are happy, some people are sad. Right? And, you know, justifiably so from our respective positions, but that's all going to change. It's changing all the time. So where do we ultimately find our peace? So in meeting, as Bodhidharma says here, the mind should remain unchanged, unmoved, even by the winds of good or bad fortune, and in that way be in accordance with the Dharma. So when we encounter other people and encounter the three poisons in them, and again, people here could be individuals, it could be any groups of people, to accept them with an open heart and without complaint, to let the mind be unmoved. What is that saying? You know, one of the gravest delusions of all in Buddhism is to think that that means meet it passively. That's not what that means. And this is most important. That's why it's so difficult to talk about this. Because when our minds are steeped in dualistic thinking, that's not just a superficial thought process. It's a completely integrated way of being in the world. And so when we hear one thing, we can very easily think it's all this and it's not, and it's all this and not that. Or if we hear this, it's all this and not that. I mean, this is what's happened. This happens all the time. And so to accept it with an open heart and without complaint, with the mind unmoved, doesn't mean to meet it passively. But then how does it mean to meet it? With an open heart. and with the mind unmoved, with the mind undisturbed. So how do you do that when your mind is disturbed? I was thinking of this in terms of these students from the school in Florida in Parkland who have been organizing and going to meet lawmakers. Shouldn't they be complaining? Shouldn't we be complaining? Greg, in his article, said, you know, that in the moment when somebody reaches for a gun in anger, in hatred, in intense isolation, they're at their worst. That should not be a time when it's possible for a person to go pick up a gun. You know, that's the time when we're at our most dangerous, our most vulnerable. That's the time when we need the most favorable conditions, not the least favorable. And so that's why legislation matters. Right? How intentions find their way into policy matter because they create impactful circumstances that have very real consequences. And so shouldn't these students be complaining, expressing their dissatisfaction and annoyance? Well, the whole world is filled with complaining. And so when we look at this more closely, this is a path of liberation. It's a path of actually affecting change. Is complaining doing that? Complaining being just an activity in and of itself, for its own right, for its own purpose. Is it actually helping us to cease from harm, practice good, and actualize good for others? So that's what I mean when I say it's an ultimate path, taking us to the ultimate ground of being. And of course, as practitioners, you know, we will generally agree to that, that presented with hatred, with bias and bigotry, with sexism and racism, with injustice and inequality, that needs to be met with compassion. But it needs to be met. It needs to be effectively changed. When we are the recipient of that, when we are experiencing suffering, when we are experiencing that anger, in that moment, do we still want to not create harm? Right? We all know the experience of wanting to hurt the one who is hurting us, of hating the hater, of wanting to kill the one who is killing. And so I hear from lots of students who are involved in different groups of going to a group that is really organized around meeting various forms of intolerance and finding within that group profound intolerance. Or groups where the main things that people have in common in that group is that they hate the same people. Right? Not very conducive, right? And yet easy to do, easy to understand, easy to plug into. That's why it's an ultimate path, because it's demanding so much. Oh my God. Right? It's demanding so much of us. In fact, I think it's demanding the ultimate of what it means to be a human being. It's so easy in meeting duality to just fall into that very duality and become it. And so when we're being asked to wield great power, the power of our thoughts and words and actions, and to do that in a way that doesn't create more duality, doesn't create more suffering. But it's hard when we have so much power. You know, that's why it can feel so good when you feel, you know, when you hurt somebody or you take somebody down, even if it's just in your mind, right? Whereas if you actually just practice it, do the hard work, it doesn't always feel that good. You know, it's hard not to get drunk on that power, drunk on that, particularly when there is an injustice and it's real and we see it. How do we wield that power and the power of others? I remember talking to a young military, a guy in the military many years ago. He's probably 23. And he flew Black Hawk helicopters, which are essentially multi-million-dollar killing machines. And they're very good at it. And I said, what's that like? I mean, I'm looking at this guy. He looked like a baby. And I said, what's that like? And he said, most of the guy, he said, I hope I don't ever have to use it. I said, God bless you, man. I hope you don't ever have to use that too, either. And he said, but you know, most of the guys I fly with, he said, they can't wait to use it. Of course. I mean, you train for it, you're in this thing that's all about this. Who wouldn't want to use it? So to hold that power, to take every step, meet every conflict, every heartbreak, every offense, without creating more conflict, heartbreak, offense. An ultimate path. To accept with an open heart, just start there. Oof. Just to keep your mind open, your heart open. Just to keep the person in front of you a person. And all of this, of course, applies equally to ourselves, right? In our own practice, to meet that within ourselves, our own tyrant, our own bigotry towards ourselves, our own hatred, our own anger, to meet that with an open heart, with patience, without hatred, without complaint, but without being passive. That within, when the mind is disturbed, to not be disturbed there. How big do you have to be? You're big enough. How stable? You are stable enough. The perfection of wisdom says, don't stand in your eyes. Don't establish yourself in your eyes, in what the eyes see, in seeing itself, and in the feeling that you get from what you see. Don't establish yourself in that feeling. This is why the Buddha said that the whole mass of dukkha, of suffering, essentially is the skandhas. When we establish ourself in our sense organ, the act of its experience, contact with the world, and then the feeling that arises from that contact. It says, the Buddha, a perfectly enlightened being, seeks no place for support. Right? We talk about, you know, being mutually supportive all the time in the Sangha, but what he's talking about is seeks no place to establish their happiness, seeks no place to find their identity, seeks no place to create a sense of permanent security. Acceptance alone is not enough. We have to practice in the 10 directions. If we're not accepting, open-hearted, but are impatient or angry, upset, then we are going to be creating karma. And sometimes that's just going to be necessary. It's just going to need to happen, right? Because you're angry, because you are upset. And you may be upset for a very good reason. You may be, in a sense, rightfully upset and angry. And yet to establish ourselves there is not going to help us. But we are angry. We are upset. And so we're going to create karma out of that. But the karma that we create can be profoundly affected by the conditions of our mind. by the conditions of our thought processes, by the awareness of being a practitioner, of holding ourselves accountable to our own actions, to our vows. Did I say this isn't going to be easy? Different situations, different people, different circumstances. And when we talk about entitlement, privilege, you know, one way I think we need to understand that is for some of us, it's going to be harder. I mean, how could we measure it? It's immeasurable. But the obstacles are much more, many more, more ubiquitous. And the bitter truth is that each of us has taken, from the perspective of rebirth, has chosen this life. Because in the teachings of rebirth, you choose this life. Admittedly, it's coming from grasping, but still, it's a choice. And so, the life that we have is the only life we have to practice in. But that also means we have to, as we create conducive environments, we can't limit that to our own space. It has to be larger than that. And so the practice of seeking nothing, I'm not going to be able to really address the rest of this as I should. I apologize to Bodhidharma and to you. So the practice of not seeking the Dharma is the practice of completely understanding this body and mind as the body of the Buddha. This life, this moment is arising in perfect accord with its conditions, and it may be wrong. And both of those are true. And so the fourth is practicing the Dharma. And doing that in a way that Bodhidharma says comes down to giving ourselves away without regret. And the greatest gift is to give up the attachment to the self. Because then all the Bodhidharma is pointing to here becomes our natural mind. Without begrudging, to give without regret. And so to meet all things as they are means to meet things as they are. In every relative sense and in the ultimate sense. I'll end with a short verse. On a bright winter morning, a shout rings out. Within the great vastness, a cry is heard and subtly answered. When the wind stirs and waves form, know that this ocean is peaceful and true all the way to the bottom.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.mro.org.